Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
And a very good morning to you. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn saying welcome to this edition of Africa Link on Wednesday, the 3rd of June. Coming up, as Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, leaves for a trip to Niger and Chad, we look at the signals this is sending to the rest of the region.
I think the fact that he has also placed, you know, solidifying and improving relations between Nigeria and her neighbors as being one of his first acts of decisiveness after his inauguration is also an issue which might, afford him a lot of respect by regional governments.
And the spokesman for the government of South Sudan tells us why they are expelling the UN's top aid coordinator in the country.
He said on the CNN that the leadership in South Sudan was failing its people and that the country was on the verge of collapse.
Those stories and more on this edition of Africa Link. Stay tuned.
Top story.
As many as 50 people were killed when a bomb exploded in a busy meat market in the northeastern Nigerian city of Maiduguri on Tuesday. Nobody has claimed responsibility, but the blast bore the hallmarks of the militant Islamist group Boko Haram. Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, says defeating the group is a top priority. He flies to Niger today and Chad on Thursday. Those two countries are supporting Nigeria in its efforts to end the insurgency, but have complained that the last government under President Jonathan didn't cooperate with them sufficiently. I asked Ryan Cummings, chief analyst for Africa at the risk consultants Red 24, what Chad and Niger were expecting from Buhari's visit.
I think all parties to the counterinsurgency operations being conducted against Boko Haram will obviously be looking for greater cooperation, not just in terms of logistical assistance, but also cooperation on the ground. I think that one of the biggest points of contention, specifically by the Chadian forces, who, as we know, actually deployed their military to Nigerian territory, was the fact that no joint operations were being conducted by Chadian and Nigerian forces. Seemingly the armies of both countries were operating in isolation in different parts of the northeast, where Boko Haram tends to be most focused. And also another issue that the Chadians had raised was the fact that a lot of areas that they had liberated from Boko Haram was supposed to be secured by the Nigerian army, given that Chad was never mandated to operate as an occupying force within Nigerian territory. But basically, the Nigerian army never came to the party. And when Chadian forces withdrew from these areas to obviously conduct counterinsurgency operations in another region, that the Boko Haram militants would just then take advantage of this vacuum and reassert themselves in territory that was liberated.
Buhari has even gone so far as to describe the presence of foreign troops in Nigeria as a national disgrace. Isn't that position going to make military cooperation with other nations rather difficult?
I think Buhari's rhetoric in this regard needs to almost be placed within the context in which it was said. It was noted a few weeks before Nigeria's elections, actually at a time when the initial ballot was postponed to the 28th March when it eventually took place. And I think the emphasis that Buhari was placing on the time was that maladministration and a lack of decisive governance by the Jonathan regime had created a situation where Nigeria's military needed to almost be rescued by foreign militaries, and that there was a dependence by the Nigerian government on regional assistance in the fight against Boko Haram. And I think that this is slightly different to Buhari being opposed to regional intervention. And I think the focus should be that regional cooperation, specifically between Nigeria and its neighboring governments, needs to take place from a position of strength as opposed to a position of weakness, which was how it basically played out under Jonathan's tenure.
How is President Buhari regarded in Chad and Niger? What sort of a welcome can he expect?
Well, it's very difficult to say at this stage. I think that the big issue, or maybe not an issue, but I think there is a lot of respect for Buhari, given the fact that he served as quite a successful member of the Nigerian armed forces and has always been seen as a man of action. I think the fact that he has also placed, you know, solidifying and improving relations between Nigeria and her neighbors as being one of his first acts of decisiveness after his inauguration is also an issue which might, afford him a lot of respect by regional governments, and also the acknowledgement that Nigeria is unable to fight Boko Haram by themselves, which again is something which is a bit far removed from, you know, the Jonathan regime, who always attested as having the insurgency under their control.
Ryan Cummings from Red 24. Staying in Nigeria, financial crime agents say they have arrested 21 bankers, including senior executives from the country's central bank, in connection with the theft of $33 million worth of banknotes in the Naira currency. The old banknotes were earmarked for destruction, and cut-up newspapers were allegedly used to cover up the theft. Now, fighting corruption was one of President Buhari's election promises. But how optimistic are Nigerians that he will be able to deliver? Sam Olukoya reports.
It was highly expected that President Muhammadu Buhari used his inaugural speech to assure Nigerians that he will not go back on his campaign promise to fight corruption. And this is what he said.
As far as the Constitution allows me, I will try to ensure that there is a responsible and accountable governance at all levels of government in the country. For I will not have kept my own trust with the Nigerian people if I allow others abuse theirs under my watch.
During the tenure of the immediate past president, Goodluck Jonathan, several high-profile cases of corruption were reported, but the culprits, in most cases, were left scot-free with their huge loot, while others, like the former governor of the Central Bank and current emir of Kano, Lamido Sanusi, were ousted ostensibly for reporting high levels of corruption. Many ordinary Nigerians believe that just how Buhari handles the first case of corruption reported under his administration will give an idea of how he wants to handle corruption. Aki Oke is one of those who feel that Buhari's presence as president is already instilling fear in the relevant agencies like the judiciary and the anti-corruption agency, EFCC.
People are already doing the right thing, even without being asked to do the right thing. You should understand, because okay, now he's saying moving forward, right from the day he takes over, he's going to be serious about corruption. Anything, any case, it won't interfere. You understand? So I'm sure EFCC will work better now. The judiciary as well will work. Tweet about some things there.
But while many people believe in his commitment to fight corruption, Buhari did not publicly declare his assets after he was sworn in like he had promised. This will leave doubts of how much he acquired during his tenure after he leaves the presidential seat. The refusal by many Nigerian public office holders to declare their assets when they take office and to make another public declaration when they leave office is one way through which many public office holders have secretly enriched themselves. Many Nigerians, like Mayowa Adebola, a social media activist, are calling on the president to lead by example by publicly declaring its assets.
And the president promised to declare his asset publicly. Now he has declared his asset privately. He's just been president for a few days. He could still come out and change his mind and declare it publicly. For me, if he doesn't do that, he would have a loss of integrity. He said this thing and we believed him. So we're counting on him to keep to his words.
Fighting corruption will no doubt be one of the main challenges to confront the Buhari administration.
Sam Olukoya reporting.
Africa Link, every weekday on DW Deutsche Welle.
South Sudan has rejected an appeal by the United Nations to halt the planned expulsion of the World Body's top humanitarian aid official in the country. The move to expel Toby Lancer, deputy head of the UN mission in South Sudan, has been condemned by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. South Sudan, which is caught up in a civil war, faces one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. 2.5 million people face severe food shortages. I asked South Sudan's government spokesman, Atini Wiig Atini, why they had decided to expel Toby Lancer.
Toby Lancer was expelled against the background of the statement in Geneva, which was deemed to be irresponsible statement by the government, because the role of United Nations in South Sudan is to complement and implement and supplement the work of the government, because United Nations, the UNMISS, and mandate in South Sudan makes it a partner to the government of South Sudan.
What was it that upset you about this statement?
He said on the CNN that the leadership in South Sudan was failing its people, and that the country was on the verge of collapse. So he's trying to put people of South Sudan on despair instead of giving them hope. He is here to support the government. He is not here to anticipate the collapse of the government.
But your country is facing grave difficulties, and the UN is helping to feed millions of South Sudanese people. Isn't it perhaps a little illogical to kick out the top aid coordinator?
I understand South Sudan is undergoing some difficulties, but not to the point of collapse. Yes, I also understand that it is not easy for those who think that South Sudan took good decisions, which is unilateral on itself. But this is what any sovereign country can do. If Toby Lancer was to say the same statement in any country in the world, he would have faced the same situation.
Toby Lancer was going to leave anyway. Why didn't you just let him go rather than expelling him?
We want to send him a message that the statement he made was irresponsible, so he has to take it on his CV, so that he doesn't, one time when he's actually accredited to any country, he has to respect the sovereignty of any country he might be working for.
But there is the danger, is there not, that that message of yours could be misunderstood?
No.
But it could be interpreted as an attack on the whole of the UN effort in South Sudan.
No. United Nations knows that even individuals are responsible, to their act when they are actually trying to discharge their duties as humanitarian workers. They have also to observe the laws of the country they are accredited to.
Do you envisage any difficulties in working with Mr. Lancer's successor?
Not at all. We have welcomed the gentleman from Ghanaian origins that was appointed as a successor to Toby Lancer. We don't have any problem with the mission itself. The United Nations mission in South Sudan is here under the mandate that we have all agreed as government. So there's no any difficulty with the successor.
But you have rejected an appeal from the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon asking you to overturn this decision to expel Mr. Lancer. Haven't relations between Sudan, South Sudan and the United Nations reached a low ebb?
We have not rejected the call of the UN Secretary General. He has not yet communicated the appeals officially. When it is communicated officially, it will be to the President of the Republic. And it is the prerogative of the President of the Republic to overturn any decision. This is what our Constitution says. So we have not yet received the appeals.
That was Atini Wiig Atini, spokesman for South Sudan's government in Juba.
Behind the headlines.
In Ghana, many lawmakers are suffering from a chronic shortage of office space. Some of them have even been reduced to working from their cars because desks and suitable premises aren't available. But now that could be about to change. And as we hear in this report from Isaac Kelechi in Accra, the parliamentarians' image, as well as their work, has been suffering.
Because of the absence of office accommodation for members. When you come, members are just loitering and gallivanting just around, and that doesn't augur well. The public will want to meet with you, both from the people from public offices and private entities may want to have interactions with you. When they come, where's the office accommodation? So you don't have any conducive environment to engage in public service delivery.
A Ghanaian member of parliament expressing concerns about the lack of office accommodation for the country's lawmakers. MPs here haven't had the opportunity to work in an office since 1992, when Ghana returned to constitutional rule. They have had to resort to their cars to undertake research and many often meet their constituents and attend. It wasn't just the lack of office space, but also the absence of research assistance that made it extremely challenging for them to do their work properly. Former Information Minister, now MP for Ablekuma in the Greater Accra Region, Fritz Bafo, explains.
What we need on a personal basis are researchers to research into topics of our interest or things that you're going to lay on the floor. So it's the research assistance that we need, and then that kind of backup. So we'll be able to then contribute better.
Many MPs on the floor of the House fail to make meaningful contribution to parliamentary debates because they are not well prepared. Juliana Azuma, one of the oldest female MPs in Ghana's parliament, says they need more support.
Research is a very, very important aspect of being a parliamentarian. It will be good if we can have some people who have had some kind of experience in this research to work with us. And I think, you know, we will benefit from that.
For Deputy Minority Leader Dominic Nitiwol, the office facilities are more than just a building.
It is an arm of government, and every FP's office is supposed to be looked at as an office. But because of the system we have run so far, we think it's just about the member of parliament, does it? But it's wrong. In fact, you are supposed to have a huge staff working for you. I'm sure that in the next 10, 20 years, the office of the member of parliament will not be what you see today.
Successive governments had tried for years to secure an office complex for the MPs. Finally, the current government successfully funded the completion of the ultra-modern office complex that is very close to the lawmaking chamber itself. The leader of parliamentary business, the majority leader, Alban Gbagbin, told me how the new office space will be distributed.
We have about 45 of our members serving as ministers or deputy ministers of state. And so we will give the rest a priority, and then the remaining offices, we may have to call on our colleagues in the executive to share some offices.
Ghanaian pollster and political analyst Ben Efsin says the MPs will no longer have any excuse not to be thorough with their work.
It depends on how they use it. The office itself will be meaningless. They have to make sure they get research assistants who do research on what they will say. So it is good, but you know, it's like giving two women the same ingredients to cook. It will never taste the same. So it's how they make use of what they have.
As the MPs move into their new offices, they won't have time to sit back and put their feet up on their new desk. Their constituents will be expecting 100% performance now that the days of politics in cars are over.
Isaac Kelechi reporting from Accra. You're listening to Africa Link, coming to you from Deutsche Welle in Bonn, Germany. Today sees the start in Cape Town of a meeting of politicians, business leaders, development officials and civil society representatives. This is the World Economic Forum on Africa for 2015. The WEF first came to Africa 25 years ago. Much has changed in the meantime, in particular the impressive growth figures that some African nations are now posting. Yet that growth has so far failed to bring prosperity to the great mass of the poor. Assumpta Latus has been talking to Winnie Byanyuma, Executive Director of Oxfam International and one of the speakers at the WEF in Cape Town. What were her thoughts on Africa's future?
Africa's economic rise, which we all celebrate, is leaving many Africans behind, particularly its youth. That's what is worrying. Africa's working age population is expected to double to 1 billion in the next 25 years. It will be bigger than both China and India. That is really a warning bell for African leaders, because this young population could be a blessing for Africa. It's a huge potential for Africa's growth, but it could also be a demographic bomb. If Africa does not invest in these young people, in their skills, and in jobs for them. And we are worried because Oxfam see that whereas 7 of the fastest growing economies in the world are in Africa, also 6 out of 10 of the most unequal countries in the world are in Africa, with South Africa being the most unequal.
Africa is having a lot of challenges, and some people say that conflicts are the major or main reasons why Africa is underdeveloped, because we are concentrating on resolving conflicts instead of trying to come up with big ideas on how to develop ourselves. What do you think about that?
I think it's a valid point that really we lose too much in terms of lives and resources and time to conflict, and that African leaders should now be totally impatient with undemocratic regimes and with wars, and should use all the pressure that they can to prevent war, and when it happens, to resolve it, such as now in our region here in Burundi. The country has agreements that were made in Arusha to bring peace. The country is just beginning to wake up from conflict. There's absolutely no reason why it should now return to war, and people should go back to refugee camps. Right now, Oxfam is responding to refugees and supporting refugees in camps when they should now be on the path to development. Only because a leader wants another term in office, which for many is not allowed through the Arusha agreements, is in breach of the Arusha agreements that brought peace. I mean, this for me should not lead a country to war.
That was Winnie Byanyima, Executive Director of Oxfam International.
Opinion.
And in Opinion this week, we'd like your views on one of the big issues being debated in Cape Town. How can economic growth that benefits all Africans be encouraged? What can be done to ensure that development is sustainable? We'd also like to hear what you think about Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari. Are Chad and Niger the right destinations for his first trip abroad? Remember, it's very easy to get in touch with us. Send an email to feedback.africa@dw.de. A letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. Or an SMS to country code 49 160 957 59510. And don't forget, we'll be airing your comments in our regular Friday fixture, Your Say. There are a number of great Deutsche Welle prizes to be won, so do write to us and tune in again to Africa Link on Friday. Our main stories: Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, leaves for Chad and Niger today on his first foreign trip since taking office. South Sudan has been seeking to defend its decision to expel Toby Lancer, the UN's top humanitarian coordinator in the country. And we've also been hearing about office space for parliamentarians in Ghana and the start of the World Economic Forum on Africa in Cape Town. By the way, before I leave you, if you're walking around with a smartphone, then you might like to know that there is a new Deutsche Welle app available for Android and Apple. You'll find it at Google Play or iTunes. And the full title is DW Breaking World News. That's DW Breaking World News. I'll be back again at the same time tomorrow. Do join me if you can. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.